My guest, Russell Banks, is the author of Affliction and The Sweet Hereafter, which have both been adapted into films. He was recently named president of the North American Network of Cities of Asylum, an international organization which provides refuge for writers whose lives are threatened in their own countries. Banks' new novel, The Darling, is about a woman, Hannah Musgrave, who in the 60s was a member of the radical group The Weather Underground. Tired of living underground as a fugitive under the name Dawn Carrington, she moved to West Africa, where she married a Liberian and got caught in the country's civil war. The novel begins years later in America when she decides to return to Africa, and we learn the story of what happened to her family there. Reviewing The Darling in the New York Times Sunday Book Review, Mary Gordon described the book as a symphony of history, politics, and impossible failed dreams. Here's a short reading in which Hannah is describing why she married her husband.
So what was it about Woodrow Sundiata that brought me to believe that I had fallen in love with him and that made me, after a few short months, decide to marry him? My initial attraction had been mostly sexual, and within weeks, once I got used to his rigid, nearly expressionless face and constricted manners, had weakened somewhat. I no longer saw him as an African samurai. What exactly, then, did I see in him, other than a benefactor and protector? If it wasn't the color of his skin, perhaps it was the fact that he was African, that he was pointedly not American. In those years, I was bone-weary of my war against everything American, the war against American racism, the war against the Vietnam War, the war against the system, all of it. It felt like I'd been at war my entire life, even as a child and adolescent waging the war against my parents. I hadn't realized it until after I'd left Ghana and Zach, my last links to the movement. But by the time I arrived in Monrovia, I was, in a sense, shell-shocked.
That's Russell Banks reading from his new novel, The Darling. I'm interested in that sense that she describes in that paragraph of being perpetually at war against parents, at war against the war in Vietnam, against racism, against the system. Would you talk a little bit more about that sense of being constantly at war?
Well, I think what I was trying to get to there is that anyone, well, particularly, let's say, Hannah Musgrave, who is anyone who is as profoundly engaged in moral combat as she is throughout her adult life and youth even, is there because of a whole braid of motives. I mean, some of it's psychological and familial, some of it is situational and historical, some of it is ideological, and some of it is simply and purely moral principles. And it pervades everything. It isn't just, you know, one or two issues. It's temperament. At some point she says temperament trumps ideology. And I think that's what I was trying to get to. What makes up temperament? And her temperament happens to be that of somebody who is in combat.
Her father is a famous doctor, and her family is very prosperous. Mm-hmm. She's very guilty about her sense of privilege, mm-hmm. about the family of privilege and entitlement that she was born into, and I think that's part of her reason for becoming a radical.
Yeah, class guilt, privilege guilt. That and you know, I don't want to dismiss or step around the real historical circumstances too. I mean, we mustn't forget this is the late 60s, early 70s, and that was a particular historical situation, and a lot of people reacted to it as well. I mean, it isn't just simply reducible to her family dynamic, although that's certainly a factor at play. I mean, that was one of the things I was trying to get to, Terry, in the book was the complex net of motivations that operate, so that we don't just simply reduce someone like Hannah or even that an entire generation to a kind of caricature. You know, it's funny right now, of course, with the election, we're thinking about, we're refighting the whole culture war and Vietnam War in many ways over. Positions taken by, say, John Kerry and George Bush are not taken in that era. And we're reducing our analysis of those two men and everyone around them, really, to one or two motives or one or two impulses or reasons for taking a position or not taking a position, when in fact there are dozens and dozens of them. And in a sense, I guess, a novel can get at those that net, that cluster of motives in a much better way than most of us do through journalism or other kinds of accounts.
So what about you? What was the closest you came to becoming part of a larger radical group in the 60s or 70s?
Probably formally, the closest I came was in organizing the SDS, Students for Democratic Society chapter at Chapel Hill when I was at college. And but then that was about as far to the left, as far to within an organization that I actually got.
Now, I read about you. Tell me if this is accurate, that there was a period when you were thinking of joining Castro's Revolutionary Army.
Yeah. Well, I made my feeble attempt at that. I was, after all, 18 years old, and Castro, this was 1958, Terry, and that time Castro was a romanticized figure on the cover of Life magazine called Dr. Castro, and he was like a Robin Hood, portrayed as a sort of Robin Hood figure in the mountain fastness of the Sierra Maestra, and I hitchhiked out of New England on my way south to join Castro, and got about as far as Miami in the winter of 58-59. In February, Castro marched into Havana and no longer needed me, needed this 18-year-old boy who couldn't speak Spanish to come to his side. So I got a job moving furniture in a hotel, and my life took on a different kind of swirl.
I want to ask you about the relationship that you've created for your main character with the African who she marries.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in the United States, when she's living underground, she becomes so disillusioned with men that she has an affair with another woman, and neither of them really think of themselves as lesbians. They're just mm-hmm. both kind of tired and fed up with relationships with men
for
the moment. And lonely, yeah.
Yeah.
But in Africa, in Liberia, with the man who she marries, she puts up with things that she'd probably never consider putting up with the mm-hmm. States, relating mm-hmm. to birth control and, mm-hmm. You know, gender roles and...
Fidelity, yes.
Fidelity, yes. So tell me why you created that predicament for her.
Well, I didn't have a plan, and that's in as much as it evolved, and I was aware of the fact that she's like a changeling, and that she's an extremely adaptable person, perhaps too adaptable in many ways, and keeps moving through identities depending upon the people that enter her life. There's a great story, actually, where the title that the title of the book alludes to, "The Darling," by Chekhov, and it's about a woman who is a changeling, and I've always been deeply moved by that story because it's extremely compassionate towards a character that might otherwise be easily dismissed by almost any one of us, and I feel this way about Hannah Musgrave too, because she is a woman who moves through identities and in a kind of constant quest for authenticity, and none of them quite fit her. And the role that she ends up playing in Woodrow Sundiata's life, or the role he ends up playing in her life, perhaps, creates an identity for her that is, in a sense, fresh and new, even even though it's in profound conflict with the identity that she wore as Don Carrington, in the Weather Underground, or earlier on as kind of this proto-feminist adolescent named Scout. It was part and parcel of her character, Terry. That's really how it came about. And it wasn't that I had a plan or a scheme or a message, for that matter.
My guest is Russell Banks. His new novel is called The Darling. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Russell Banks. His new novel, The Darling, is about a member of the Weather Underground who becomes tired of living as a fugitive and moves to West Africa, where she marries a Liberian and gets caught in the country's civil war. Your character of Hannah is a radical who comes from a very privileged background.
Mm-hmm.
You were a radical who came from a very working-class background.
Right.
And I'm wondering, when you met people like Hannah in your real life, what you made of the fact that they were from very comfortable backgrounds and now were now voluntarily, you know, identifying with the working class, living a life with little or no money and few comforts. Did that make sense to you? Did you think of them as being like less authentic or more fake or, you know, just...
Yeah. Well, yeah, I did back then. I mean, one of the reasons, actually, I wrote this book, I think, you know, now that it's done and I'm looking at it, I can see it more or less as a reader and less as a writer, and I can say, well, why was I doing that, and see what's on the page and reason backwards from it. And I think one of the things I was trying to do was to avoid or to step around and maybe get away from the stereotyping of someone from Hannah's class, because I did do that. The biggest stretch for me was not that she was a woman, but that she was from a privileged background, and I'm not. And so I did have to come to a kind of compassionate understanding of the melange of motivations and forces that were at play in her life. I couldn't just simply stereotype her the way, in fact, I did stereotype people from her background who went into radical politics, did as a young man and well into my adult life. And it took me perhaps until now. I don't think I could have written this book with the kind of sympathy. I've written a book about a character like Hannah with the kind of sympathy, with the kind of compassion and, I hope, understanding that I managed to write it now, these many years later.
When you were a young man, do you feel like you tried on different identities through the desire to or the need to?
You know, I think I sidestepped some of that, a lot of that, really, because by having committed myself fairly early on, and really in my early 20s, to a life of writing, to dedication to an art, in a way, and bending my life to the discipline and rigors of that, having done that, you know, fairly early in my, you know, as I say, in my early 20s, that really kind of created an identity for me that was flexible enough and yet fixed enough and had enough models and examples in front of me that I didn't go through the kind of shape-changing, certainly, that Hannah goes through and that a lot of people, most people, go through. So I didn't have a midlife crisis, as it were. I didn't have, you know, a career change or a sudden desire to go out and buy a red Porsche and so on in my 40s. I more or less evolved out of that early, you know, format, which was really because of my time and my era, rather, and the models that were around me was more or less formed out of, you know, male writers who preceded me.
So tell me more about how you think writing saved you from that kind of shape-changing or midlife crisis.
Well, it saved me from a lot of troubles, actually, because I was a very turbulent and angry young man. And it gave my life a real meaning. Storytelling, writing, put me under a kind of discipline and focus that I couldn't really have achieved any other way. I mean, I might have achieved it had I become a Zen Buddhist and dedicated my life to that practice, or who knows, you know, done 10 years of psychotherapy or something. But it had the effect, really, of stopping me and making me sit down and pay attention to the world and to my perceptions of the world, and put me under the discipline of a craft, of an art that really had the effect of saving my life and probably saving someone else's life as well.
Do you ever look back at your younger self as if you were a fictional creation and ask yourself, what was it that shaped the violent side of the personality?
Sure, I think so. I've learned a lot from writing fiction on just about why and how people do the things they do. And so naturally, I've applied whatever I've learned from writing to my own life. It's a form of, I guess, autotherapy or something, but certainly, you know, if Hannah Musgrave does what she does for a multitude of reasons, from, you know, historical and ideological to personal and familial and so forth, then I do too, whatever I do, for a myriad of reasons, and so I can sort of untangle that braid in the same way. In myself, in the same way I can untangle the braid in Hannah's life.
And I fear it would be too reductionist for me to ask you to untangle that particular braid. yes? should I not? I mean, I hesitate. I just feel like I'm going to ask you to be giving a simplistic answer about why you were that way. So I hesitate to ask.
Why I was this turbulent, angry, and violent young man?
Yeah, is that?
No, I can answer that. I think that there's a whole lot of reasons, though, and I can't just simply reduce it and say because my father was an alcoholic and was violent, which happens to be true, or because I was born into a working class family where male physical violence was, if not celebrated, was certainly admired in certain ways. Or because I was born in 1940 and my parents were Depression-era parents and I was born into a patriarchal family, I'm very much a male-dominated family. Those are all at play. The time and place that I was born, northern New England, 1940, was a factor growing up in the war years and then the late 40s and early 50s was a fact. They were factors. All those things were at play. So I'm. You're right. I mean, I am avoiding a simple reductive answer to it the way I would avoid a simple reductive answer as to why Hannah behaved the way she behaves.
Well, Russell Banks, thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you, Terry. It's great to be here.
Russell Banks' new novel is called The Darling.